The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce Gordon Campbell. If you're a gardener, this time of year probably has you thinking about sprucing up the backyard. And though today it sounds bizarre, and even indecent, to use a person merely to provide garden ambiance as a living, breathing symbol of rural withdrawal, live hermits were the height of fashion for the British gentry in Georgian England. And the practice's deep roots extend all the way back to the Roman Empire. The hermit was a public symbol of cultivated melancholy and the spiritual benefits of privacy and peace. In his new book, Campbell, a professor of Renaissance studies, traces the history and the lasting influence of one of the most fascinating trends in the history of landscaping. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Gordon Campbell.
Good evening, all. It's good to be here. I come to the States once a month, oddly enough, as I'm involved in a museum of the Bible that's being built in D.C. I'm the historian. And I've been in Pennsylvania several times, but it is, I blush to say, my first time here. And I'm pleased to be here. Now, the title about which you've just heard a bit from Laura, it must seem to you the oddest topic you've ever heard of. It certainly seemed that to me. I'll tell you how I found it. Many years ago, 40 years ago, I was doing a PhD in England on John Milton. And one of the things I learned about Milton was that in the 18th century, he was dug up when the church was being renovated, and the sexton who was in charge decided he could make a little money on the side by selling off bits of Milton. So you could buy a jawbone or a tooth or a bit of hair. The hair was very popular, it helped to supplement his income. And I decided at one point that I learned that there was an essay by Edith Sitwell on the subject called something like On Digging Up Mr. Milton's Bones. And I thought I really should go and have a look. And I went to the appropriate point shelf in the library, and I found Edith Sitwell's essays. And I opened it up, and I turned to the contents page, and I went down the contents page looking for the story on Milton's bones. And I suddenly saw an essay called Ancients and Ornamental Hermits. And I thought, Milton can wait. And I stood there, and in the aisle, I read this bizarre essay about people who built follies in their gardens, and those follies included hermitages. And the hermits they had sometimes were wholly imaginary, which is to say, on there would be a bit of furniture inside, and on the table there might be a pair of eyeglasses and a newspaper, and the hermit had perpetually stepped out for a moment. And there were others who became their own hermits, aristocratic landowners or gentry landowners, and there were still other hermits who were real people, who were usually illiterate agricultural workers who were hired to dress up, usually in a druid's costume, hermits. No, there wasn't complete agreement on what constituted druid's costume. It usually involved something that looked rather like a dunce's cap. So there were all sorts, and there were also automata, built of twigs or built of plaster, talking ones and so on. The first one I'm going to tell you about is at Hoxton, which is on in the Welsh. It's actually in England, but it's on the Welsh border. And it's a bizarre landscape that some of you will have seen in the C.S. Lewis film about Narnia, which was filmed on this site. I regret to say that the hermitage doesn't appear in it. This is actually a replacement hermitage because 4 years ago some local schoolboys burnt down the real Hermitage. They were smoking inside. And anyhow, it was destroyed, so this has been rebuilt in its place. But Hoxton was owned by a man called Sir Richard Hill. And in 1783, a guidebook appeared written by Mr. T. Rodenhurst. Now, I looked around for Mr. T. Rodenhurst and eventually decided that he didn't exist. There is no evidence of such a person. My guess is that Mr. T. Rodenhurst is, in fact, Richard Hill, the bloke who owned it. But anyway, so he had a fictional version of himself write the guidebook to his property. And he says, there is a well-designed little cottage, which is the hermit's summer residence. You pull a bell and gain admittance. The hermit is generally in a sitting position with a table before him, on which is a skull, the emblem of mortality, an hourglass, a book, and a pair of spectacles. The venerable barefooted father, whose name is Francis, if awake, always rises up at the approach of strangers. He seems about 90 years of age, yet has all his senses to admiration. He is tolerably conversant. Now, this Father Francis, the post was hereditary. It was always held by someone called Jones. And this is a Mr. Jones from, the beginnings of photography. It's an 1860s one. So he's a successor to the one I've been describing in 1783. You can see the skull in front of him. And he was, you can see the fake beard. And I disapprove of fake beards. And the wig. And there he is, prepared to say hermit-like things like the stars are dark tonight, or similarly enigmatic sorts of things. Now, sometimes, he being very elderly, he was replaced by an automaton that moved and a voice could be projected. There was a visitor in 1801, for example, who took his wife and son to see the hermit. And this was clearly Mr. Jones's day off, so it was the automaton in his place. And he says, on putting your questions to him, his lips move, and he answers in a dark, hoarse, hollow voice. He coughs as if almost exhausted. He told us that he was 100 years of age and that he had resided there the greater part of his life. Now, the voice was apparently that of the gardener, who had a way of making the hermit's jaw go up and down. So it's a very odd phenomenon. You can see a bit of Latin just on going over the door. It's Procolo procol esti profani. It's from Virgil 6. People in England of my generation recognize it, because anybody that studied English at Oxford... In the first year, you had 6 papers, 2 in Old English, 2 on Milton, and 2 on Virgil, and one of them was Virgil 6, and it means, keep away, O you who are uninitiated. When that generation dies off, no one will know what those words mean. But anyhow, that's what it is. So I started out trying to understand this phenomenon, which goes back to antiquity and has, the notion of retreating to the garden in a hermit-like way. It has all kinds of cultural vestiges now that I'll talk about in a few minutes that range from garden gnomes to the shed in the garden to the man cave within the house where the man retreats. All of those things. Now, it begins, I think, with real hermits in gardens. And the earliest one I found is a French one. It no longer exists, but it's 1506. And in the garden, a cardinal, so a religious figure, built a little summer house on the right, and he built a hermitage, which is in the square on the left. And that's the earliest surviving one. The designer was Italian. It's possible there were these things in Italy, but none survives, nor does any record of them. But The fashion spread to Spain, and this is a hermitage, one of seven hermitages. Here's another one in the garden of Buen Retiro, which was done by Philip IV. Philip IV built this huge palace. There was a monastery up the way, so he created a path, an allée to the monastery, built these seven hermitages, that's one of them, and got the monks to supply hermits to live in them. And these are real religious, you know, they're real monks. And yet they're used for, well, they're used to sort of point to his spirituality, but they're also used for court entertainments. Now, Counter-Reformation Catholic Christianity is a very interesting phenomenon, and it accommodates the religious and the secular in quite remarkable ways. So there is no problem in the minds of Spaniards of the 17th century of combining genuine hermit-like living with picnics, court picnics, which is what they had. That one was used by the Prime Minister for his picnics. So there's that original. But beyond that, there's a building that some of you may have seen in the gardens of the Vatican. Its origin is very interesting. To the east of Rome in Tivoli, there is the remains of the Emperor Hadrian's villa. And in the villa, within the villa, there's a little area that's a pond, a circular pond, and in the middle of the pond there's an island, and the island's about 10 feet across, and there's a little causeway that leads to it that originally had a ramp so he could go out. The building there was covered with an umbrella-like thing. We don't know what was in the building. I suspect a deck chair and a supply of gin and tonic. It was a place where the emperor, when he was tired of running the Roman Empire, could escape all by himself and just relax for a bit and read a book or whatever emperors do in their off moments. I've never met an emperor. Now, when the Roman Empire fell, that site was covered up. And in the Renaissance, the late Renaissance, in the 16th century, the papal architect, a man called Piero Ligorio, conducted what was really the world's first archaeological dig. He was looking for artifacts. And he dug up the emperor's circular villa, the island villa, and he realized what it was. And he came back and said to his pope, "What you need is a little place beside the Vatican where, when being pope is all a bit too much, you can withdraw and, you know, the deck chair and all the rest of it." And this is it. It was named in honor of Pius IV, so it's the Casino di Pio IV. And it's a tiny little set of buildings for day use, for afternoon use only. It's now, oddly enough, the headquarters of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, but only about 10 of them could meet in it at once. The gardens of the Vatican, if you haven't been, are well worth visiting. When I went in to take photographs of this, I discovered something very interesting as I went into the gardens, which is that the Pope sells gasoline. You go in and there's a filling station. And I wondered what he was, you know, how much he was charging for gasoline. It worked out at about 28 euro cents a litre, which I convert quickly. It's just under $2 a gallon. And I thought, this is a good place to buy your gasoline if you happen to be in Rome, but you've got to be on the right side. So this started the idea of the little building to which you withdraw beside the big building, in this case, the Vatican Palace. And it went from there. At Versailles, Marie Antoinette built this village, this hameau. It's around the lake, a circular thing. It has a little dairy, for example, where she could go and dress up as a milkmaid and show her children how ordinary people lived without the inconvenience of having ordinary people actually there pointing out that they were hungry. One of the prototypes of the little place in the garden. This is one, it's hard to see on the slide, but one of the antiquaries, William Stukeley in England, decided to put it just in his little garden, which is smaller than mine. I have a quarter of an acre. But he built just on the right a little hermitage, which is the first one in England. Now, this one at Payne's Hill, that's in Surrey, just to the south of London. You can see the hermit in the window. That's been rebuilt. The original one, a house was built nearby, and the hermitage was very handy for firewood. And over the course of the years, it all disappeared into the flames. But the Payne's Hill one is a very interesting one, in that it... there was an advertisement for the hermit here, and for a very long time I couldn't work out whether there was a successful applicant for the job. But it turns out I finally found someone. I didn't find him actually. He was found by a local historian, a man called Remington, who he took on the job of hermit, and it had the usual clauses of staying in the hermitage all day long and not leaving the estate and so on. But he only lasted 3 weeks because he was found in a nearby pub. And indeed, there were stories that later developed about improper relations with a milkmaid. So he was dismissed, and I last hear of him locked up in a hospital for the insane. Maybe he was a bit odd even to start off with. But anyhow, that's the Payne's Hill one. Now, Tong is a very odd one. Not all hermits. The hermit, as you can see, is down in the right-hand corner. Not all hermits are respectable. And it took me some time to work out what this hermit actually was. And I found out, it turns out someone else was thinking exactly the same. And indeed, he was the dean of a local cathedral and not the sort of person who thinks the sorts of thoughts which I'm going to explain to you now. But it turns out, when you go round the estate, which is in Shropshire, there are various odd things. There's a pulpit built into a wall, and there's a building that looks like a convent just by the gate. And there is a bishop's chair. But when you sit in the garden, but when you sit on the bishop's chair, the seat gives a little, and water pours on you from a tree up above. In other words, it's a joke chair. And it turns out to be a joke pulpit. And it turns out that the convent where the gatekeeper lived, the gatekeeper was a prostitute who dressed up as a nun. And this particular hermit was, in fact, a procurer of material for orgies, ranging from women to whatever. It was modeled, it was a provincial version of Sir Francis Dashwood's Hellfire Club. That particular one, they called themselves hermits as well. So there is a disreputable side to the story. Now, how does one get to be a hermit, and how does one acquire a hermit? Well, one answer is that one advertises. And I found in a journal called The Courier, the 11th of January, 1810, a young man who wishes to retire from the world and lives a hermit in some convenient spot is willing to engage with any nobleman or gentleman who may be desirous of having a hermit. Any letter addressed to Mr. Lawrence, post-paid, to be left at Mr. Orton's house in Plymouth, mentioning what gratuity will be given and all other particulars. So you advertised, you know, experienced hermit seeks new position. Some of you will have seen Tom Stoppard's Arcadia, which has an ornamental hermit in it, and Lady Groom, who comments on the issue of advertising, says, "Surely a hermit who takes a newspaper is not a hermit in whom one can have complete confidence." Now, there are others. There's one near Bolton, where a man called Powis advertised for a hermit. £50 a year he was paying for life, for someone who was willing to undertake to live 7 years underground without seeing anything human, so he's not ornamental, you don't actually get to see him, and to let his toe and fingernails grow and his hair and beard during the whole time. Apartments will be prepared underground, very commodious, with a cold bath, a chamber organ with as many books as the occupier pleased, and provisions served from his own table. Whenever the recluse needed any convenience, he was to ring a bell. So there was cave service for this particular hermit who could ring his bell. Singular as this residence was, an occupier offered himself and stayed in it for 4 years. So there's somebody living underground for 4 years. He couldn't have been ornamental because no one could have seen him. So a whole series of advertisements that begin to appear. Now, some people became their own hermits. Now, this is Selborne. The Natural History of Selborne, Gilbert White, is I think, probably my favorite book of the 18th century. Gilbert White was a clergyman, Church of England. His interest in theology was zero. What he was really interested in was his garden, which he wrote about, and he kept a weather diary. And he is the first, he's the remote progenitor of people like David Attenborough. He's the first naturalist to work from the living world rather than from specimens. So he worked out, for example, listening to finches, that a certain subspecies of finch had four varieties. And he did this simply from listening. He's a wonderful, wonderful character. And he built two hermitages at Selborne, where his church was, and you can see one of them there. And he had his other interests included growing cantaloupes, which he did on an industrial scale. And he would have little parties, and people would come to visit, and the parties would be in the hermitage, and he would give them cantaloupe. But he needed a hermit. So he asked his brother Harry, who was a vicar about 10 miles down the road, another Church of England clergyman, if he would like to be a part-time hermit. And Harry designed a costume, which you can see him wearing there. It looks like a nightcap he's wearing. And he acted the part of the hermit, writing little verses, occasionally serving the white wine. He was a sort of waiter-come-hermit, and he would tell charming stories. And he liked being the hermit so much that he commissioned a painter to paint him as the hermit of Selborne. And that painting survives in a house in the north of England, in Cheshire. And that's it. Now, isn't it astonishing? So what happened to the hermits? Why did they disappear? I have a colleague in California who once worked on the hypothesis that there was some kind of hermit strike, because they all disappear at once, and he wondered if they took industrial action, and that this is why they were replaced by plaster casts and by twig statues and so on, which is what happened. I no longer think that's the case. But I think two things happened. The first, in the case of Hoxton, that first hermit that I, the man with the false beard, the first hermit that I showed you, one of the people who wrote about Hoxton at the time said the popular voice against slavery, this is the time of the abolitionist movement, induced the worthy baronet to withdraw the reality of the hermit and substitute the figure. So the idea of having a hermit looked a bit too much like having a slave, at a point when slavery became an exceedingly sensitive issue. And that seems to have been one of the elements. Now, clearly, in the case of the Hoxton hermit, it didn't work, because within a generation, one of the other hermits was still there. And indeed, the Hoxton hermit stayed on until the early 20th century. The estate was sold to a hotel, and the hotel decided to keep the hermit on so that the guests in the hotel could go out and chat to the hermit. And it was one of the facilities of the hotel. So the anti-slavery, abolitionist sentiment was part of it. And another part of it was that the whole thing was built on the notion of pleasurable melancholy. Now, when we talk about melancholy in the 21st century, we would use a word like depression. And depression isn't a good thing. It's a medical condition. You know, you go and you get treated for it. So the analogy isn't a very good one. Melancholy in the 18th century and indeed before that is a sign of emotional depth. So if you're miserable, you must have profound emotional capacity. That's the reason why Hamlet comes on in black, representing his melancholy, and cannot be cheered up. And what it means is that being noble, he has great depth of intellect and great depth of emotion. If you believe that, you'd believe anything, but that's a separate argument. The point was, melancholy was something desirable, something that was cultivated. The graveyard poets of the 18th century, Thomas Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard, it's all part of the cult of melancholy. And the cult of melancholy came to an end. And it came to an end when people like Horace Walpole said, for example, it is preposterous to set aside a corner of your garden in which to be melancholy. And you can see the point, as it were. So one way or another, the hermits gradually disappeared. Now, they lived on in attenuated form. In the 19th century, for example, the part of London known as Vauxhall, which you will know from the James Bond films because it's where MI6 is, MI6 is on the site of Vauxhall Gardens. It had a real hermit who was in a papier-mâché tent who would tell your fortune for you. So the hermit was reduced to being a fortune teller. It's an indignant end. Now, I've thought a lot about what happened to these hermits later on in the 20th century. And one possible line of thought is that they're related to the garden gnome. Now, garden gnomes have their own history. They come from an area in eastern Germany called Thuringia, which was a mining area. That's why they, in the early ones, they carry pickaxes and so on. And they were brought to England, and there were two famous collections. One is near, in the middle of England, close to where I am in Leicestershire, and it was a man called Sir Charles Isham. So gentry, he's got a title, and he creates a gnome garden of ceramic gnomes about 3 feet high that he brought in from Germany. That garden, when Sir Charles died at the end of the century, his ungrateful daughters, think King Lear, threw away all the gnomes, but one of the gnomes escaped by digging its way into a crevice and was discovered some years ago, and that gnome now lives comfortably in the house and is insured for £1 million. It's the earliest gnome in England. The other gnome collection was a man called Sir Frank Crisp. If you know your Beatles well enough, George Harrison's ballad of Sir Frank Crisp, the site passed, the garden passed into the hands of George Harrison. His widow, Olivia, still lives there. And it had the other great collection of garden gnomes, these things. And those of you who are really Beatles persons will know the album All Things Must Pass. And it has on the cover George Harrison with a selection of his garden gnomes. When the Chelsea Flower Show, which was on last week, decided to do a memorial garden for George Harrison, they would not allow the gnomes in because gnomes have become working class. They're very common. And Chelsea is top people, so they wouldn't allow it in. But as it happens, they've changed their mind just this year, just for the 1 year, and the gnome that's insured for £1 million, that one that lives near me, he's the first gnome to come and visit Chelsea, which I think is rather nice. What then happened to gnomes was Walt Disney. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Along comes Walt Disney. He makes them cute. He gives them cute names. They're called Grumpy and, you know, things like that in 1937. And thereafter, gnomes are made of resin and then of plastic. And instead of being gentry things for the rich and the titled, they become things that absolutely anybody can put in their garden. And I see them all over the world. I was in the Falklands last year and in Port Stanley on the main street. There's a garden that has a huge garden gnome collection. So it appears that the descendants of the ornamental hermits are the garden gnomes. Now, I'm going to finish by taking 5 minutes, I think, to just show you some hermitages. There's the Friar Park one. Now, the hermitages are the only material survival, if you like, of some of these hermits. This is at Stowe, which is a National Trust garden, and it's a copy of the very first one. That hermitage had an imaginary hermit in it, taken from Spenser's Fairy Queen. But notice that it's ruinous. There's no tower on the left corresponding to the tower on the right. So although it's an architectural hermitage, it was built as a ruin. This is Badminton. That's a drawing early on when it was in trees, and this is what it looks like now. The whole thing is made of tree stumps, including that doorway. This was the only hermitage I wasn't allowed to photograph. The Duke of Beaufort, who owns Badminton, said no. So I'm happy to show it to you, but don't tell anyone. And in the book I've done, I use a photograph from 1910 instead of this one. This one, in deepest Lincolnshire, is a very odd survival, because the garden, the main garden of the house, which is the Earl of Yarborough, who has two distinctions. One is that he converted to Islam a few years ago, and the other is that he is the most cash-rich of any member of the British aristocracy other than the Duke of Westminster. But he has fantastic gardens laid out by Capability Brown, who disliked hermits and hermitages. But hidden in the woods is this little hermitage. And that's an upturned, the V of a tree, as it were, has been inverted. And the amazing thing about it has no door, is the furniture survives. And this is in a woodland, 18th century furniture. You can see the hermit's chair at the back there. His four visitors can sit there, and the hermit's table. And there it sits. I'm astonished it's not been vandalized or whatever. Nobody pays any attention to it at all, but I think it's the most wonderful survival. This is one in Derbyshire that was a real hermitage that was recycled in the 18th century. So in the Middle Ages, it was a monastic hermitage, but then it became a sort of picnic spot with an occasional hermit visiting. This is one in a garden in Eastbourne that puzzled me for a very long time, because I looked, the inventory had a list of things that were in the hermitage, and it included a telescope. I couldn't work out what a telescope was for, and a stuffed sheep. Now, why does a hermit need a stuffed sheep? And what I finally concluded was that when the hermit left, they used it as a kind of storeroom for things that they didn't otherwise want. And I wasn't looking at the mysterious goods owned by the hermit. I was looking at the household junk. That was an anchorite's cell. If you know about anchorites, they were people, hermits who were walled in forever. In the Middle Ages, there was a little hatch left so they could be handed food, and that was it. They lived their entire lives incarcerated in prayer, and that became, again, another picnic spot. This is, I think, the best hermitage. It has wonderful 16th century glass in it, and it's called the Bear's Hut, because in the 19th century, a Canadian bear was kept in it. Now, the inside is beautiful, so either this was a very well-behaved bear, which seems unlikely, or the National Trust has rebuilt it. Now, this is one near Birmingham, and you can see the inside of it. This is a contemporary drawing, blackness, a plaque in memory of something. It's a place to go to be miserable. It's owned by a 19th century industrialist. Now, this one I put to you just as an example of what happened to the Hermitage afterwards, because in the 19th century, it moves out of the woodlands and it becomes a sort of garden feature. You put it in a corner of the lawn, and you can go, and there's a little bench around the edge there. So rather than being a habitat for a hermit, it's simply a place to go. Now, I'll finish with a few from Scotland. This is one that Dorothy and William Wordsworth went to, and it's in Dorothy's journals, and you go through a little tunnel to come out where that doorway is, and there was a hermit who had lined his cell with fur, and you could look out the window, and where I'm standing taking the picture, there's a waterfall that you could look at. This is another one that Burns visited in Scotland. The woman who owned it told me that it was an ice house, but it's not an ice house. It's another hermitage. This is one by the Duke of Buccleuch, and as you can tell, it's not much loved. And indeed, when I arrived at the estate, they said there's no such building. But I asked if I could look around, and there it is in the grounds. That's one where the Wordsworths went. And the Wordsworths are a funny lot because Dorothy, William's sister, was a really nice person. And William, what's the opposite of really nice? And he was shown the hermitage, and he said, we laughed at the stupidity of the man who was showing it to us. And I squirm at that. But that's a Burns one where he wrote things. And finally, a few in Ireland. Mrs. Delaney, who is there was a wonderful exhibit at Yale. There's a little hermitage in the center there with a bench in it where she could bring a woman friend. That's another in Ireland that's recently been recovered from, it was just entirely covered in overgrowth. That's one that belonged to a hotel, and I went to the hotel and I said, you have a hermitage in your grounds, and they clearly thought a lunatic had walked in, and I found this thing and took this picture, and it's now in the hotel brochure. I'm quite pleased with that. So that's in the grounds of a Cistercian monastery. And I felt a little guilty, you know, what's the protocol on disturbing Cistercians? But anyhow, he was the meatiest Cistercian ever who said, "Ah, yes, the hermitage is just down there, turn left." Again, the roof needs attention, I think. Patrick Pearce, as in the IRA, it's the school that Patrick Pearce ran, and he was executed by the British at the Easter Rising, and 18 of his pupils were executed by the British. It's one of the most shameful moments of British history, unless you're an American with an even longer memory. But that was the Easter Rising of 1816. So I'm going to finish with these and just take you to my last slide, to the last hermit. Arlesheim is about 10 miles from Basel in Switzerland. And there's a park, and it has a hermitage in it. And this is the second hermit in residence. The first one was built in the 1760s, and I'm not quite sure of his date, but he's roughly mid-19th century. And when you go into his hermit's cell, if you drop a coin in his, you see he's got a little bowl in his right hand, and the bowl has a little hatch in it, so the coin goes through the bottom, and he acknowledges the coin by leaning forward in grateful appreciation for the donation that you've made for his well-being. And that, I'll stop there, I think, but it is the most extraordinary survival to see that the last hermit lives in a Jardin Anglais in Switzerland. But I think he's quite handsome. Okay, we'll leave it at that. Right, we can take if you have a few minutes, I'm happy to take questions or comments or arguments. Now, there's a lady back there. There's a microphone back there. Well, I can hear you, but we're recording this for posterity. So it's the only way we can record you.
Somewhere. So my question is there any relationship between the hermitages and the mausoleums of the 19th century?
There is indeed. And the mausoleums have within them not just graves, tombs, but they also have places to sit very often. And the purpose of sitting in a mausoleum is to be miserable. And you're often not remembering someone that you know. They're not places for grief. They're places for melancholic remembrance. So as far as I can tell, and there are architectural links as well, there is a link between, say, the skull that the hermit holds or the hermit has on his table to remind him of mortality, and those places where you can sit in mausoleums. The other place where this kind of thing happens is by waterfalls. There's often a cave, and you can go to remember someone. They're memorial places, and you can sit in this little cave to keep the rain off, and you can think of your friend who has died or whatever. So in that case, there is a bit of grief. But yes, both architecturally and even more importantly in terms of the sentiment that goes with it, the mausoleum and the hermitage. The grotto is another relation, and occasionally grottos at Hoxton, for example, the hermitage had a hermit, and the grotto had a wild man. It'd be good having a job as a wild man, wouldn't it? Nothing is known of in what way the wild man was wild, but I imagine he sort of had looked rather like John the Baptist, and was generally uncivilized. So yes is the answer. Anybody else, sir?
Thank you. Very stimulating. I have two questions. Number one, the coins that the hermit collected, what did he spend them on? What, you know, where did he go shopping? And two, the etymology of gnome, does it come from the same root as to know, and where they were, because you hadn't mentioned anything about wisdom or storing knowledge.
On the first, with the exception of the one in the cave, the guy who was issued with an organ, but not given organ lessons, he was paid £50 a year. But the others are all paid at the end of their term as hermit. So they have no spending opportunities, no retail opportunities when they're actually in service. But then they get this big pile of money, which is enough so that they never have to work again. And for many people, that's quite an appealing, me, it's quite an appealing possibility. Gnome in English comes from gnomic. It is related to that. So it is knowledge that is perplexing. So you're absolutely right in your etymology. But post-Disney, the gnomes were transformed by Disney and they became part of a narrative about Snow White, didn't they? And although they're full of common sense and compassion, you wouldn't call a gnome dopey if you were thinking in terms of wisdom. So they lose that characteristic when they become commercialized. Good. Yes. I can see you're all going to go out and buy gnomes. Yes.
Oh, we have a hermit in Philadelphia, and I...
Pardon me? Do you?
Yes, at a Catholic church.
A real hermit.
Right. So I met these ladies who said they're the hermit's caretaker. So I got into a fight with them because I said, well, if you feed and take care of the hermit, how is the hermit a hermit? Because I thought a hermit lived in isolation and separation from the world. I'm very sorry, I missed the beginning of your talk, so I don't know whether there was a definition of a hermit. But anyhow, these ladies were very aggravated by me when I questioned them on their daily caretaking of this hermit in Philadelphia. Is that? And then you mentioned a hermit being fed. Isn't part of being a hermit being in isolation, separation from the world?
The real hermits vary enormously. Those that are Carthusians, for example, are fed. It's like Well, some of you are old enough to remember American houses that had a milk hatch with two doors on it. And this was an L-shaped milk hatch, as it were. So the outside person would put the food in, but it couldn't be seen because the hermit took it out from the 90-degree approach, as it were. But there are also hermits who retreat for a time. They're often close to monasteries, the one in Derbyshire. But they come down when they are spiritually refreshed, which can take a matter of years, and rejoin the community again. The relationship between those habits and the ornamental garden hermits that I'm talking about, that are entirely secular, is, how remote is it? There is a connection. But the garden hermits, on the whole, don't represent anything spiritual. They're simply part of the landscape. There are a few exceptions to this that I've wondered about. In Northern Ireland, the landowners in the 18th century were all Protestant, and the local labor available for being a hermit was all Catholic. So you didn't really want to hire, if you were a Protestant, you didn't want to hire a Catholic hermit because it sounded a bit Catholic. But there was one landowner in the south of Ireland, an aristocrat, Lord Kenmare, who was Catholic. And he, alone of all the people, the landowners in Ireland, had a real hermit. And he was a secular hermit, but he sort of hinted at the old religion. Now, he was used in a wholly secular way. The hermitage was on an island in the ruins of a monastery, and it had a window that had a flap on it. And the Lord Kenmare used to entertain there, and the hermit kept a supply of white wine inside the hermitage, and he became the bartender. So if you were Lord Kenmare's guest, you went past the hermitage. It was a sort of food hatch. You got your glass of wine, and you went along, and someone else outside was boiling salmon, and so you got a bit of your boiled salmon. So it was white wine and boiled salmon with the white wine served by the hermit. And that's very interesting because it reaches back to that easy Catholic accommodation of the social and the religious. He's as close as you can get to a religious hermit, and I find it very interesting. No one at the time ever wrote about him, so it's all inference. So I take your point. There are also, there have been modern hermits who aren't religious. There have been three advertisements in the last 5 years. I've thought about applying, as you can imagine, and two of them at country houses and one in a museum in Manchester. And three of the jobs were secured by the same guy, who was a very successful hermit. These were jobs for 2 weeks only. But he dressed up, he is a New Age character, dressed up as a Shaolin monk, and lived in complete silence, except he was addicted to 1970s jazz, which is a very unusual preoccupation for a hermit. So no speaking was allowed, but 1970s jazz could be heard the whole time. And he talked about spirituality in all of this, so he wasn't very much like an 18th century ornamental hermit. Who else?
I was struck by the, dilapidated look of many of the hermitages. Mm-hmm. They're sort of like not, they didn't try to be architecturally beautiful or anything. And you used the word folly.
Yes.
I remember a folly someplace in France in a garden, the picture of a folly. And it seems to me that the image in France, that image was so beautiful. Why was there a difference between the French interpretations of an hermitage and the English?
The answer is no.
Why are they so dilapidated?
There are two. The French ones are the English garden was exported in the early 19th century to the continent. So it became the Jardin Anglais. In France, it became the Giardino Inglese in England, the Englischer Garten in Germany, and so on. And there are hermitages scattered all around these. But hermitages come in two architectural varieties. One is the shabby chic kind, like the one in the picture I wasn't allowed to show you, which is made of tree stumps and that sort of thing. And it's supposed to look natural. And it's often It's often beside an immensely elegant Palladian mansion. So it's a shack, as it were, of a sort that you sometimes see at the seaside when people build a shack to live in for a few days. Other hermitages were designed by your architect. So at Kettleston in Derbyshire, for example, the architect who designed the main mansion also did an architect-designed hermitage, which is unbelievably elegant. It's invisible now in that it's crumbled, but the original plans show a lovely little building. And when you think about it, the first of these, that building in the gardens of the Vatican, is immensely elegant, isn't it? Beautifully done. I mean, Piero Ligorio. That's right. So the answer is that some of them are shacks, and the difficulty in terms of survival is that they've mostly disappeared. I mean, I've shown you all the ones that do survive. Whereas the architect ones, where you had your architect run it up for you, they're stone. So on the whole, they've survived, even if the roofs have caved in. Okay? Yeah. One here.
Good evening, sir. You mentioned at the beginning your work on the history of the Bible.
Yes.
And since you mentioned something that you are an Englishman also, I wonder if you think the idea of the English Christianity somehow applied the British experimentalism to whatever they inherited from the Catholic Church, and so they lost the sense of what a hermit is.
Yeah.
Or the needs, the English need to discredit the other. Practically, popes and stuff like that, they are mostly, they are hermit in a sense.
It's a lovely question. In terms of English Protestant antagonism to Catholicism, at the extreme, the hermitage that I showed you, the painting that I showed you at Tongue, and indeed Sir Francis's Hellfire Club, both had chapels in which black masses were performed that made fun of the Pope. So, in other words, they were vitriolically anti-Catholic. It's appalling, but I simply put it to you as a historical fact. And that kind of anti-Catholicism in the 17th century was stoked up by the rebellion in Scotland. And you'll know from my name, Gordon Campbell, that although I'm English, I have Scottish roots. And the argument about who should be the king, should it be the Catholic pretender, or should it be the house that indeed is still now in charge, was something that divided the nation and created an immense dislike of Catholicism in the mid-18th century. That is part of the reason why the hermitages are so secular, because people don't want to get involved in that kind of debate. So it's a very secularized form of art. And you can see it in all sorts of other kinds of art. I mean, if you move to the Netherlands, one of the most popular genre paintings is of the Holy Family on the flight into Egypt. And in early versions of that, there's a great big donkey with Mary and baby Jesus and Joseph walking alongside, and there's a few trees in the background. And gradually, those figures get smaller and smaller and smaller, and the landscape becomes a much larger piece of the painting. And eventually, the figures simply disappear. And although they're sometimes called the flight into Egypt, there are no figures at all. So that process of secularizing that you can see in those paintings that created landscape painting is exactly the same process that creates the secularization of the hermit. And I mean, most of the hermits that I've been talking about have not a whisper of a religious dimension to them. Okay? Anybody else? Have I exhausted you? One more. Right, we'll do one more.
Obviously, you're not talking about a St. Jerome-type figure.
No.
A real hermit. You're talking about a folly. type figure.
I am, yes.
That would entertain guests when you had grand weekends or grand estates that you had to entertain people with various entertainments. And that may have been why they eventually disappeared with the Industrial Revolution and the just people not being able to put people up for 2 weeks on a hunting expedition or whatever. It seems as though they were just follies in that sense.
They were. But there is a debt to those early ones architecturally, not specifically to Jerome, because he lived in a cave guarded by a lion. But there are Renaissance depictions of the early church fathers, mostly German, but sold widely in Britain, in which the little huts that they live in are the exact prototypes of those huts that I've been showing you. So it's mediated through, I mean, what are really grotesque misrepresentations, imagined, you know, these are what these ancient hermits lived, how they lived, which they didn't in the least. But the belief was that these were the secular successors to those early church fathers who chose an eremitical life. So you're absolutely right. Okay, are we there? Well, good. Take the rest of the day off. Thank you for being a lovely audience.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.